sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Japanese equities are crushed. First three-day drop for the S&P in 2013. And we have new breaking up and breaking down setup videos that we've been posting. And we have guest Al Brooks and much more on episode number 315 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, happy Memorial Day to you. This is Andrew Horowitz. I apologize for the one-day delay of this week's edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, but I was busy at my lake house, and we wanted to make sure that we were as close as possible to when the equities open up, futures open up in the United States and around the world. And I thought that maybe you'd give me a break and let me have just one extra day in the sun and fun. We did some great smoked meat. We had some really cool smoking of some pork, and we had great hamburgers, hot dogs. I made some really neat meals that you can only do when you're kind of outside the big city, it seems, where you can get some ingredients that aren't the norm. And I must tell you that it was beautiful on the lake this weekend. A little bit breezy, just a little bit breezy, but it was absolutely gorgeous. Took out the jet skis and did some tubing and lots of fun here in South Florida. So I hope you had a great time and spent your extended weekend in a way with your family and friends that you'll remember, and you'll have that for many years to come. I wanted to go over a lot of things because we do have a great guest on today, Al Brooks. He's been on before. He's a trader, and he kind of looks at patterns and pattern recognition from a different angle than we're used to. And I wanted to bring him on and talk to him about some of the things that he's seeing. But before we do so, I think that we need to cover some of the important news items that have been coming our way over the weekend and last week, as well as the fact of what's kind of to be expected for the next week or so. Yeah, we did see that Japanese equities were down 7% in one day, in one trading session last week, and then it was followed up by a slight uptick of about 0.5% or 0.75%. And we're already seeing that futures moved lower, and then when they first opened up on their Monday, Monday for Japan, they were down 3%, the equity index, the Nikkei, and pretty much across all their indices was down. And we're seeing that slight move down for futures already into Sunday evening. We'll see how that all plays out. We did see also that in China, the industrial profits gained and were continuing to grow up about 11% year over year, down a little bit from last month when you look on a year over year basis. And that is somewhat contradictory to the numbers that we recently saw when we saw the HSBC Flash Index, the manufacturing index that was in contraction territory. But China is just a story of contradiction, because the imports, exports that we've seen recently are now under fire, not only by outsiders looking in wondering how it's possible that there was this much exports when in fact it was really down overall from around the world. And China now is looking into it because there's been some discussion that it's about only a tenth of what they say it is, because of some of the cross-border movement of things like gold and other kinds of materials that really are meant to be investment into the country rather than actually materials that were bought for manufacturing. And this movement has created a doubling, if you will, or maybe even more, of some of the theoretical exports and imports in and out of the country, and that is causing quite a discussion. And if, in fact, manufacturing keeps on slowing there and there's a contraction in many of the areas, you have to assume that there was something off dramatically with the export numbers. Yes, we also did see this is the first time in 2003 that 3 days in a row, 3 days in a row, it was hard enough to get 2 days in a row, 3 days in a row it was down for the S&P 500. It was down for most markets 3 days in a row. The Dow managed to squeak out a little bit of a gain on Friday, but It was down pretty hard to begin with, like we've seen a couple other days recently. And then miraculously during the day, there's all these buyers that show up, and then it starts to fade towards the end of the day. That's what happened the first 2 days. On Friday, there was a continuation of this, but then the buyers continued on buying. The volume was light, and the buying overwhelmed the sellers, and there was pretty much a dead draw for most markets at the end of the day. But again, besides the Dow Jones, but they were down overall. Now, this is all on the heels of the commentary from the Fed that said that maybe we're going to start looking for an exit plan. And those words really started to resound in investors' ears and wondering, what does that mean? Even though Bernanke is saying that they could raise or lower the bond purchases moving forward, dependent on the economic data, the question really is, wait a minute, are they trying to prep us here a little bit for the fact that they may start slowing down some of their stimulus? The fact is that if you look at some of the numbers and you look at the employment numbers and you look at the broad base of the economy, you know, maybe there is a point to slowing down some of the purchases at this point to see if the economy can continue and maintain its own level of growth, however mild that growth may be and however benign that growth may be, but to see if it can really start to do something on its own. In other words, is the engine primed enough? It's been cranked. Is it time where maybe you should let this thing, you know, take off the training wheels and let this thing start rolling? Especially with the fact that there's been over 500 plus rate cuts from around the world over the weekend. Israel dropped their rates again in a surprise move. And this is something that's probably going to continue on for a while. It's the only tool they really have, many of these countries, to do. You know, what else can they do? Europe really doesn't have the opportunity to do any kind of quantitative easing, at least by their structure and the statute. And Germany recently came out just over the weekend and said this is not something that's really in line with what they're going to be doing, at least allowing to do for the Eurozone. And you have Japan, obviously, you know, talking it up that, hey, there's a green light for equity investors. And then we did see the market still continue down over there. So it's down about somewhere around 11.5%, 12% since its recent high. And that came really in just a matter of 3 days of trading overall. That's significant, and that was again predicated on the fact that the yen has strengthened from about 103.5 to about 101, and it did come down a little bit lower. And that is one of the things that is a big concern, as I've mentioned to you. If you remember something, that my thesis has been that the recent rise in commodities, if there are some, and holding up oil, and the move that we saw in equities around the world, a lot of that had to do with the fact that there was significant amount of short selling of the yen, and which, by the way, continued over the weekend. In fact, we have some of the highest level of short positions on the Commitment of Traders report in terms of futures than we've seen in a very, very long time. So the futures traders are now all on one side of the boat. And remember, I'll remind you this all the time. When we see that kind of a move, where you see a news story come out that says that the hedge funds and institutional traders and speculators are considerably short or long, and it is some of the highest levels of readings that they've had in a very long time, it should send a signal. It should send an alert, a flag up and say, wait a minute, what happens if that turns? What happens if that moves the other way? What you're going to find is that more often than not, when it does turn, you're going to see a very swift move in the opposite direction, because a lot of the players have to either cover or sell their positions to square up. And when you have that many on one side, it becomes a very quick-moving situation. I think I've mentioned also to you that we are short here for our clients, the Nikkei. We're also short the JGBs, the Japanese government bonds, and we are also long, looking for it to strengthen. We're looking for, in terms of the yen. Now, for a while, the yen was not a good position. There's no question about that. We went in and out of it, and now we're back into it. And the Nikkei, I got to tell you something, the couple of, maybe the week and a half that we had that it moved up, that move down on the Nikkei made a very profitable position. And right now we're holding that, and unless it turns around dramatically, we will take our profits on that position. And the JGBs, which was the whole idea that the Japanese are, even though they're buying at a record clip, the bonds, their government bonds, the fact is that why would anybody, in terms of an investor, want to be in those with such a low rate, with very little upside potential, at least from where it was when it was trading at about 0.5%, and now it clipped 1%, so a 100% rise in rates, even though the Japanese central bank is buying record amounts, there is a record amount being sold as well, and they are pushing rates up dramatically, thinking that the country that has a 235% debt-to-GDP ratio is not going to be able to sustain this kind of level much longer. So we're seeing all this come into play, and I think that just to get back to this without boring you to tears about this, and just to hammer it home, though, is that the yen move has been a big undercurrent for all the things that have been happening lately, I believe, when it comes to markets around the world. And if that story changes and that breaks, there's going to be a new dynamic that's going to happen, in particular because we're seeing that the economic numbers from around the world and in the United States, ex, let's say, housing, ex some of the employment numbers, are really starting to get questionable at best. And on top of that, you have the situation with earnings not really being as great as was hoped. In fact, when you look at the earnings right now for the S&P 500 and you take out the financials, because they can be scattered and they can skew the numbers a bit. So we have about 450 companies or so, ex-financials, ex-core financials. And for the most part, we've seen that the earnings season is pretty much over. When you look at the score and look at what happened, about 68% of the companies beat and surprised the upside in terms of EPS, but only 48% of the companies beat on revenues. And one of the things that happens there is that they've had to obviously come to the reality and realization that, hey, you know what? Our revenues are light because of many of the global headwinds that we're seeing, and we have to be more efficient. We have to bring in technology to keep our margins up. We have to do whatever we can to make sure that we get those earnings in because we know that they're watched so closely by investors. And that's what companies have done. And they've continued to do that. The question is, if their revenues continue to keep on moving lower, how long can they actually maintain that level of efficiency? Big question. Now, with that, let's talk about some of the earnings that are going to be coming up and figure out, you know, what this means for us. Now, we have a few companies, not that many companies really that are important, quote unquote important, reporting next week. But we do have Tiffany that will be coming out in the morning on the 28th, looking for about 53 cents on about $854 million sales. A big question there is going to be, really, what is the price of silver and gold going to translate into in terms of earnings and specifically the drop in those? We also have the Fresh Market. Last quarter, they came in with a really ugly number. We'll see if they cleaned that up a bit. And Whole Foods did a nice job this quarter, looking for 44 cents on $369 million. Costco's coming out on the 30th before the market, looking for $1.03 on $24 billion. And we have a couple of others like Guess, Palo Alto Networks. Joseph A. Bank Clothiers is coming out on the 30th, looking for 34 cents on about $200 million of revenue. The overall estimates have come down for that one quite significantly over the last several weeks. The big question is, how can they keep giving away clothes at cheap, or, you know, the one for twos, or, you know, or I should say the three for ones, the four for ones? How do they keep doing that and maintaining their profitability? More importantly, next week, we do have a lot of economics that are happening. And this is a very, very busy week of economics. We start out on Tuesday morning with the Case-Shiller, the home price index, which has been rising pretty well after some horrible numbers over the last few years. The survey is looking for about a 10.5%, actually 10.2% to be exact, year-over-year growth of housing values on the 20-city composite. That's the one you want to look at. If you see some of the headlines looking at the monthlies and all that, disregard that. You want to look at the year-over-year Case-Shiller composite for the 20 on a year-over-year basis. March to March, looking for 10.2%. Last period, last month, it was 9.32%. We're also going to have the consumer confidence number. Now, we saw the consumer confidence number before from the University of Michigan. This is the conference board, and they're looking for 71 as compared to before. Last month, it was 68. Now, the University of Michigan last period came out amazingly, at about 83.7, very, very high confidence level that was posted. And if this is a read-through of that, and we can see where we expect this to be, you know, 71 may be a little bit light. We also have the GDP coming out, which is an annualized number. There's a second revision on the 30th. We're looking for 2.5%. Personal consumption, initial jobless claims that day also. Then we have pending home sales, looking for about 12%, 12.5% on a year-over-year basis. I want to see what the personal income and spending numbers are going to be on the 31st at 8:30 in the morning, because we have seen those slow down. We're seeing that last month we saw a 0.2% gain in personal income, looking for a 0.1%, so in other words, a further slowdown. Personal spending is going to be a big goose egg, according to analysts, where it was up 0.2% last period. We're going to see also the final reading of the University of Michigan confidence on 531 at the end of the week, looking for it to maintain at 83.7. And then just to kind of bring you forward to next week, the ISN manufacturing numbers expected to drop to 50.5 from 50.7. Now, in terms of the manufacturing, I think I've been telling you this, we've seen a tale of several different situations in the U.S. We've seen, number one, that the jobs numbers are getting better. We've seen the housing numbers are getting better. But yet manufacturing, both the regional and the composites, have been lagging a bit. And that's important to look at. You have to wonder why that's happening if sales aren't really happening on the retail side and if the consumers are really starting to slow down a bit. That is something that I'm going to be watching very, very carefully. Now, before we get to some other things I want to talk about, I have some listener questions. I want to talk about the breaking down and breaking up setup videos that we're doing on a weekly basis, a couple of them a week, plus some other setups that you can be looking at, and maybe even talking about some of the discussion about the repatriating of earnings back to the U.S. right after we talk with our guests. Before we do so, let's talk about GoToMeeting. They're sponsoring this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, and you know that I use them, and I think they're great, and you can use them too for all sorts of things. They have this wonderful program that has what's called HD Faces, where you can talk one-on-one with somebody, and it takes just a click to get this going and really to start a meeting at any time that you want. You could either schedule it or start it impromptu, and you can share your screen and work on the documents in real time with other people. It's just like meeting a person in a room, really, having a face-to-face with them and talking about what you want to talk about from your computer or even your iPad. And you can get 30 days free. Try GoToMeeting by going to GoToMeeting.com, clicking on the Try It Free button, and using the promo code PODCAST. Very simple to do. Be sure to use the promo code PODCAST. GoToMeeting. Meeting is believing, and I'm sure as heck a believer in that, and I think that they have a great product, and you'd be very pleased in using it, and you get 30 days for free. Great stuff. Back by popular demand, we are talking with Al Brooks. Now, Al is a gentleman who has been training for a long time, actually an eye surgeon from years ago. He's an author. He's also a professional trader, as I said, and he is an instructor, teacher, if you will, at BrooksTradingCourse.com. Hey, Al, it's been a while. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Andrew?
I'm pretty good. I mean, I think that you and I talked at the beginning of the year. I think that was the last time, right? Do you remember?
I don't remember. I think it was longer ago than that.
Well, a lot of things have happened. I mean, this rally that we've had and the ever bouncing up, what that is, upwards, markets has been very perplexing to a lot of people. And I think also, you know, fundamentals are, you know, on one side. And aside from the buy and always hold crowd, I'm talking about the people that will look at the structures, fundamentals, you know, and they kind of will go either way dependent on that. And particularly the technicals have been very much in question in terms of a lot of people saying, you know, how is this happening? What's your take on the general market condition and what you're seeing compared to maybe even what you've seen historically?
Well, I think the comparison that most experienced traders are making is with 1995. After the Republicans took over Congress. Mm-hmm. If you look at the monthly chart of the S&P cash index in 1995, at the time, a lot of traders were calling a top. You know, Precker and the Elliott Wave people were calling a top. But month after month after month, you know, one bar, two bars, three bars on the monthly chart, four, five, six, seven consecutive bars higher and higher and higher on the breakout. And that's what the market is trying to do right now. And traders are debating whether this is a repeat of 1995 or if it is something different. If you look at the monthly cash index, we're at all-time highs, and we have a series of consecutive bull bars.
Right.
I doubt that this is 1995. Most breakouts fail. We're breaking out above the double top of the past 15 years. This breakout will probably fail. However, we're up so steeply over the past 5 or 6 months that it's unlikely we'll go straight down.
Right.
Markets usually top over the course of 5 or 6 or 10 or more bars. So if we're going to have a significant top up here, it's likely that we'll go sideways for many months. And sideways on the monthly chart could easily be 150 points from top to bottom.
Yeah, sure. No question about that. Actually, you know, you talk about the Elliott Wave Group and you talk about Precht and all those guys. I didn't know that they did anything but call tops. Did they actually call bottoms? Because I have not...
They rarely call bottoms, but I'm sure you know that they always call tops.
Yeah, they always call it a top. It's always a top.
All the way up from the 87 crash, they were calling tops.
Right.
And Mark Hulbert did a study of the results, the hypothetical results of traders following the Elliott Wave recommendations. And I believe that he found that you would have lost 95% of your capital.
Well, I mean, it's not all bad. You got some left. I mean, you can, you know, listen.
That's right.
I mean, you watch poker tables, they start with, you know, small stacks kind of can come back. But let's talk a little bit. I know one of the things I recall is that, you know, you don't use the traditional, you know, let's call it the oscillators and things like that on your charts. And you do a lot of looking at formations and patterns and things that you've seen that have worked and obviously that have been tested and that have been things that are profitable in your history. One of the things that is mentioned, as you said, is you have a multiple top that we're seeing here, you know, long-term now, tops that we're seeing. But just for a moment, I'd like to really get a little bit more granular and talk about some of the intraday action. And, you know, we've seen a lot or much more reduced volatility per se, but, you know, or even the weekly action, there's this, you know, you say it's in a bull market, but there's been this constant bid and you wonder a bit where that money's coming from. And, you know, you say, well, it's hitting technicals and, but is it really hitting technicals or is this just a, you know, an all out buying spree that you're seeing?
Well, to me, I never care. Okay. And to me, so much of it is unknowable. I don't care. All I care about is buying pressure and selling pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm constantly assessing that. Do I think there are more buyers below the current bar or sellers below? Are there more buyers or sellers above the current bar?
And tell me how you do that. I mean, there's like services like Lowry's. They'll look at up-down volume and things like that. They were pretty interesting for a while. I don't know if you look at their stuff. But how do you assess that? And let's talk about on a, you know, if you want to talk about monthly, weekly, daily bars, you know, how do you assess that?
Well, in my books and in my videos and in my webinars, you know, I have this list of things that I look for that give me an idea of buying pressure and selling pressure, and I'm constantly weighing it out. You know, for example, let's talk about the daily chart, cash index, for example. Are we having a series of consecutive bull bars? Are most of the bull bars closing near the highs of the bars?
Mm-hmm.
Are the closes above the high of the prior bar?
Mm-hmm.
You know, stuff like that.
So do you also want, you know, a lot of, over time, historically, there has been a, I'll say over the last 5 years, there's been a complaint that while there's a bull market going on, that you don't see a lot of volume. You know, volume's been tapering off, and you don't have the retail involved. Again, I understand what you're saying to me about not caring where the money's coming from, but is it a concern of yours that we're seeing that you know there's been moves that are significant on light volume, and a lot of times the sell-offs, by the way, are on much higher volume, right?
Right.
You know, but if you look at that, is that as concerning as it was years ago? I mean, years ago, it really was a very key point.
I think years ago, volume was much more important. Now, I think volume is irrelevant for the most part.
Interesting.
You know, I'm mainly interested in price action. You know, what are the bars looking like and support and resistance? You know, if you listen to traders on television like Fast Money, all they talk about is buying pressure, selling pressure, support and resistance. Mm-hmm. Are we at a trend line? Are we at the bottom of a channel? Are we at a prior low? Are we at a prior high? I also look a lot at measured moves, and I have a variety of ways to calculate measured moves that I think a lot of people don't discuss. But to me, it's clear that the computer algorithms are aware of what I'm doing, because so many turning points occur at measured moves.
So give me an example of so people that don't understand what a measured move is. Just give me a generic example of something.
All right, if the market moves a certain distance and then it breaks out, it might move the same distance. If you project down from the high of the day to the low of that first bar, right?
Yep.
The market had a measured move down to the low of the day yesterday.
Right.
Okay, so that's an example of a measured move.
So the retracement back could be, or the continued move could be similar, is what you're saying. Now, and then you can look at kind of where that's going to happen and where the gap, not a gap, but where the fill would be of that measurement.
You know, I always look to see what happens at measured moves. Mm-hmm. And I'm always looking for breakouts and failed breakouts and reverses. And there are all kinds of other measured moves that the market makes. An obvious one is a leg one equals leg two move. And the market commonly makes those. And then measured moves based on the height of trading ranges. And then there are also measured moves based on the height of breakouts. That's another very common one that I use. And it's very helpful not only to look for reversals, but for to look for profit targets and to look for entries. So I'm always looking at closes, a series of trend bars up or down. They tend to generate measured moves.
So, and you're looking at mostly, you look at daily. You don't really look at intraday, right? Or do you?
No, I'm a day trader.
So you do? Okay, intraday also. Okay, I got
and
you.
And I trade a lot of markets. Trade bonds, gold, euro, the yen, crude oil and natural gas, and sometimes stocks as well. I watch the 5-minute E-mini chart mm-hmm. throughout the day, and I take many trades during the day. Typical day, I might take 10 trades. Some days I might take 20. Mm-hmm. And then I also day trade the other markets as well, but I don't watch them throughout the day. I typically look at them for about 10 seconds every 10 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of markets out there. And obviously, it's when the ranges are wider on a day trading basis, it's a lot more potential, as we know, instead of those days that are just kind of up in the morning and it just stays the same throughout the day. And then who knows at the end it's going to go up or down. Or the days that, don't have a very big range. The big range days, obviously, are the ones that you want to look at. And those are the ones probably would have a much greater propensity of having bars in it that you could use for calculating your various ranges.
Well, most of the time the market doesn't have big ranges. Most of the time the market is unclear, uncertain. We trade in a gray fog most of the time. But I make money in those markets as well, because in those markets, I'm fading breakouts. I'm expecting a breakout to a new high to fail, no matter how strong the breakout looks. So I'm looking to sell. And I'm expecting a strong sell-off below the bottom of the trading range to fail. So I'm looking to buy. So I don't care if the market is in a strong trend or in a trading range. I just adjust my trading style to fit the price action that's in front of me.
So reversals is a key part of it, a bit of a contrarian situation there. But you're looking for, I'm going to put some words in your mouth and tell me if you think this is a correct statement that you'd make. That oftentimes, let's talk on a daily basis, there'll be moves throughout the day that may be they'll move to one direction more than maybe should be from aspect of support or resistance, and those are the ones you're either fading or buying, right? So if it goes through that level, you're thinking it's going to fail the breakdown, and then it's going to kind of pop the other direction. So therefore, you're going to be waiting for it at that level.
Right. If I think the buying and selling pressure are fairly equal, if I think the market is fairly balanced, and I see a sell signal at the bottom of a trading range. Mm-hmm. Instead of selling on a stop at the low of the prior bar, I'll place a limit order to buy the low of that bar.
Right.
If I think I see a bad sell signal at the bottom of a trading range, I buy it. If I think I see a bad buy signal at the top of a trading range, I short it.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that because there are so many breakdowns that look very apparent for a lot of reasons, let's say on a daily basis, that you see that there is limited support underneath and you see that there is a clear and present trend. And let's say 2 days later, it's still moving in that direction. And then right when it gets a little bit below, you'll notice, I've seen a lot of times with stocks, for example, that they reverse and they reverse hard. Like there's a, out of nowhere where it should have been the, beyond the breakdown point, right? Just a little bit beyond where you're kind of in a clearing. And then it just reverses the other direction very hard. I mean, I guess that's the standard in a market that the people looking to buy versus looking to sell.
Well, I mean, that's exactly what I do all day long. That's, you know, I call those buy vacuums and sell vacuums.
Mm-hmm.
And the market usually gets vacuumed below support and reverses up. And the reason for that, well, there are two reasons. One is everyone knows it's going to go down to support. So the buyers lay and wait. They wait until it gets below support and they buy. The bears know it's going to go below support. So they're scalping shorts aggressively. And as soon as it gets down to support, they buy. So they buy back their shorts. And the bulls who wanted to buy but knew it was going to test support, they can appear out of nowhere and buy aggressively. So you can have the market collapse down with one or more big bear trend bars to a support area, only to reverse up immediately because the bears are buying. They're buying back their profitable shorts at support. And the bulls suddenly start to buy, even though they weren't buying just a minute ago. You see that all the time intraday. You see these very abrupt reversals.
Mm-hmm.
And they're always at support. Anytime you see a reversal anywhere on the chart, it's always occurring at support. The support might not be obvious, but it's there. And with a little experience, if you know where to look for measured moves, if you know how to draw trend lines, you can see the support before the market gets there. So I'll very often place a buy limit order in a falling market at a support level if I feel that there's a confluence of things going on supportive of my trade.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the probability is low, even if I think the probability of success is only 40%, if the reward is three or four times greater than my risk, the math works out. It's a good trade.
That's a very, I think that's a very important thing that you mentioned there, actually, the idea of risk reward when it comes to trading, that is. And, you know, would, for example, someone take a trade that there's a equal dollar to be made versus lost? I don't know where the point of that is. You know, you want to find, usually you want to find something where the opportunity to make money outweighs the opportunity to lose money. And I think that's a really important thing. A lesson that people should take away from this discussion here is that, you know, when you're looking at something, what's the upside, what's the downside? And, you know, if the upside is X times greater than the downside, that becomes a good potential. You know, it may not play out that way, but it becomes a good potential trade.
In general, traders should only take trades where they're going for a profit target twice as big as their risk, because in general, the probability is between 40 and 60%. And when that's the case, the mathematics work out only if you go for a profit twice your risk.
Right.
However, during breakouts, the probability of a measured, of an equidistant move, for example, the probability of making 20 ticks before losing 20 ticks, sometimes the probability can be 70 or 80%, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, you can trade profitably going for a reward equal to your risk.
Right.
Whenever the probability is high, the reward is small relative to risk.
You know what's funny? We talk about how, you mentioned how on support, the bears may cover and the buyers may step in to buy the support and all that. There's been, I've had a discussion with people I know, friends, and they've talked about how terrible shorting is. And I said, well, are you kidding me? If you are in favor of markets having any kind of support, you want to have people that short, because those are the people that are actually going to, any rally from a severe sell-off over a period of time is going to be met by a turn, and that's usually because there's short covering going on. And then from there, the buyers will step in. But if there's only buyers and sellers, the fear factor wouldn't be equally weighted. And what happens is that when things go down, buyers are not going to step in. They're just not going to, at the aggressive nature that a short seller would step in to cover their positions. And I think that it's very interesting. And the other thing is that when you look at stocks, we like to find stocks on breakout potential, stocks I'm talking about, that have a significant amount of shorts that are in the position, so that when and if the breakout occurs according to the plan, you get a short squeeze on top of it. For example, when it comes to commodities, I always look for a Bloomberg article that says that the Commitment of Traders report says that oil shorts are the highest they've ever been. I know the potential for a turnaround and a short covering rally, whether it's justified or not fundamentally, is very much there. We saw that happen, I think it was last week or this week, with gold. Gold had one of the highest short levels of interest over the weekend. It was this week. And we saw a gigantic move down again for gold, and it turned around and moved not only up through the zero line, but up to positive. And that's because a lot of the short covering going on, right?
Well, you know, years ago, I used to pay attention to the Commitment of Traders, and now I don't pay any attention to it whatsoever, because you never know when the shorts are going to cover. What I prefer to do is just trade the price action as I see it. And I know there are always shorts, and I know they're always going to cover at some point. And I never worry about entering a move late. I never worry about catching the very start of a move. So if a move, let's say there is a short covering rally in a stock that is way oversold, I never give that any thought. All I care about is whether or not there's good momentum up. Is there enough momentum up for me to make a profit? So I enter moves late all the time, and I never worry about catching the exact bottom or top, although I often do catch the exact bottom or top. But for me, I don't pay attention to volume. I don't pay attention to the percentage of shorts in the stock. All I care about is the price action.
Right.
Are more dollars going into selling, or are more dollars going into buying? Mm-hmm. I just look for signs that one side or the other is in control.
So now this is some of the things that you teach, I know, in your courses at BrooksTradingCourse.com. And, you know, do you find that, you know, traders can grasp this a little bit more easily than some of the very, very, you know, advanced courses that are out there in terms of, you know, there's a lot of courses out there that get into some really ridiculous amounts of nitty-gritty, and you know, it becomes a bit of a confusing process. I mean, it sounds like you're kind of teaching a I don't want to say easy, but a very you know, where there's not too much information, is my point. You're teaching just, you know, hey, follow the trend, follow the price action, you know, utilize trend lines and things of that, tools that are available. It doesn't have to be too complicated.
Years ago, 25 years ago, 26 years ago, when I started out, I had all kinds of indicators on my charts, and I wrote all kinds of indicators, and they were all valid, but I was not making any money. I lost money for maybe 10 years, and I eventually decided to start with the basics, just a 5-minute bar candle chart. Mm-hmm. I think it was a bar chart, I don't remember. And I started realizing that without any indicators at all, at the end of the day, if I print a chart out, I could see, hey, if I bought here, I would have made money. If I sold here, I would have made money. And I started focusing on patterns. You know, why was that a good buy? Why was that a good sell? And over the years, I've accumulated a lot of patterns and a lot of ability to recognize buying and selling pressures, support and resistance. And that's how I trade now. You know, any beginner just looking at a printout of a chart with no indicators on it whatsoever will quickly see things that are going on in the chart that would make them look to buy the next time they see the chart, or look to sell. You don't need indicators. You can just look at the bars on the chart, and it does not take much training to get a sense of what is a reasonable thing to buy and what is a reasonable thing to sell.
Yep. Now, just as a clarification and a point of information, we also, you know, I understand your point there. We have indicators that we write, and we think they're really good, and they're, you know, people can get them on TradeStation and on eSignal and all that. There's different strokes for different folks depending on what you want to do. But the point is that also the thing that I think that I really appreciate what you're saying is that by printing out just a chart that's kind of price action chart, if you will, daily, weekly, you know, intraday, whatever the time period is, and then looking at it. But more importantly, I think and I remember this from our last conversation, that you would make notes on them and all, and you had a collection of these. Am I correct?
Yeah, I make I make notes on. I print out the 5-minute e-mini every day. Mm-hmm. I make notes on it, and I'm constantly trying to reinforce my. You know, it's practice.
Yeah,
it's like baseball players, football players. Everybody practices. I practice.
Right, and the thing is that I think that for anybody listening, I think one of the cool things you can do is to actually print out a chart. You know, just print out a chart for from wherever program or platform or whatever it is that you're using. And, you know, do a 5-minute, do a 15-minute, do a 30-minute, whatever, do a daily. And see, by the way, you'll notice that there are a lot of similarities, even if you didn't look at the, know what the time frame was, right? So you look at...
Absolutely. If you don't have labels on the chart, most traders cannot tell the difference between a 5-minute chart and a daily chart and a monthly chart and gold versus a Forex versus a stock chart.
Right.
They're all the same. They're all being traded by the same computers and same people. And so they're all identical.
Right. Exactly. So that's a good thing to do. That's a great challenge. I tell everybody, why don't you print out some 30-minute, 60-minute daily charts, for example, mix it up, and have somebody just either cut off all the time periods, you know, the times on it, the dates, and all this stuff, and put them next to each other. Let somebody else do it so you don't know which one it is. And then take a look at those and notice that you'll see a lot of similar patterns. I'm not talking about the complex patterns. I'm saying the general structure of
what's happening. Identical.
Yep.
On that BrooksTradingCourse.com website, on the homepage, I have an example of that. I think I have a 1-minute chart, a 5-minute chart, and a daily chart of gold, General Electric, and a Forex market. And you can't tell the difference. You can't tell which one is which.
That's, I love
They're
that.
All reflections.
Right.
See, I think price action is genetically based. I think it's a reflection of human behavior, and as long as we stay the same species, the price action is going to be the same. I've printed out charts from over 100 years ago, and I did just what you said. I cut off the labels, and I can't tell the difference between those charts and the charts today.
Huh. I love that. That's great. I think that in itself is worth a listen to the show, I'll be honest with you, because I think that will give people a really good idea, and do it on different instruments too. You know, you could just do it on all sorts of different things, mix it up. That's good practice. And I think from anything else that we've talked about, the whole idea of practicing, you know, and that's far different, by the way, than listening for a tip and just trying to invest in it, whether it's a professional tip or whether it's a tip from, you know, somebody that you know that's giving you some information that hopefully is going to play out because their son or their brother works there, whatever it may be. I think that, you know, the idea of practicing and pattern recognition is the baseline. It doesn't mean you'll be totally successful, but it's the baseline of understanding at least what's going on. So I think that's really good stuff.
May I say one point about that?
Yeah.
On television, they always bring experts on who express opinions. For example, Doug Kass, who's a very credible guy, early in January, said that the stock market was at a top.
Mm-hmm.
And that was over 200 points ago, and he's still bearish. So even if the market corrects 10%, he's still going to lose money. Tom DeMark, another reputable guy, I think it was in March, he said that the market was at a top on all time frames. And, you know, that was 150 points ago. And when someone on television or if a friend, even a very experienced trading friend, makes a recommendation for a trade, the reason I think that traders should never take it is because there's much more to trading than an entry. You have to have an exit strategy, and if you don't have that, if you don't have the trade management, just having a recommendation almost certainly is going to lose money.
Yeah, I agree with that. Because if somebody says, you know, it's time to get short or long, and you don't know if that's a short-term setup, a long-term setup, what the price is going to be, are they looking, you know, at this a great stock, that it's down, it's a great entry point, buy on pullbacks, I mean, you don't know what the level is that is really being reflected and what their time frame is, their holding time frame, that is. By the way, Doug Kass did come out and say that he's been wrong. I don't know if he's switching, but he's been wrong. You know, although a lot of times he does go back and forth and seems right every time because he says so many things that you never know exactly where things are, you know. But
he's actually very early. He's usually a month or two early in his calls.
Yeah, I mean, although I sat out on a panel with him one time, or he was on a panel, and I was listening to him up in New York, and I think the first time I met him, and he was actually so, he was scary right about shorting the retail at the time, and I'm thinking, at the time I was thinking, retail has been just obliterated. Is it, how could it, it's a short again, it's now a short again. I was thinking, wow, how's that? But it actually turned out to be a pretty, pretty good call. Anyway, Al Brooks over at Brooks tradingcourse.com. You can pick up his books also, and maybe, you know, if you get to be very friendly, he'll do an eye exam for you. Who knows? I don't know. I'm just kidding. But check it out. We'll put all the information on the website at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. This show, we'll put all the notes in there and the episode information about Al and how to get to him. Al, I appreciate it, and successful trading to you.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity of speaking to you.
Great. Have a good day, buddy.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right, good stuff there. Let's get to a listener question that I mentioned before we started talking with Al. Let me find it first, and then we can talk about it. I thought this is very interesting because one of the things that happens so many times is that, you know, there is this question about, is the stock market fair? Is there a advantage that others have in terms of, you know, finding out information before I do? And you know, how do I gain on that, and is it really something that is happening, or is it just a coincidence? And this is, I think, a question that a lot of people have. Now, we got this question from Kyle, and he asks, he says, I was just recently listening to the DH Unplugged show and found the conversation interesting about companies' stock prices going higher whenever they announce the exploration of strategic strategies. You referenced Saks in your opening discussion, and I was wanting you to take a look at the following link, and he gave me a link, and he said, I thought it'd be a good discussion because the option market, how they proceed a movement in stock directions, either by sure good speculation or blatant insider information. And you want to know, you know, kind of what's the story with this whole thing? Well, you know, that's really interesting because you would think that there's some obvious regulation, which we've seen before. And, you know, when a company does, in fact, announce that maybe there's a merger and the day before, 2 days before, some lucky investor, very savvy investor, put in $1 million into short-term options on the call side looking for it to hit a certain price by, you know, within 2 weeks. And miraculously, the stock is up 40% on the buyout. And wham, look at that, big cash out. But the question really is that something that is, you know, you know, first of all, can we do that as investors? And how do you, you know, we can't. Could we follow the options and maybe do something there? You know, you could do that. You can start looking at the highest level of options traded, which direction they're traded on a given day, and look at the trends and look at the action in terms of price and any major blocks that went through, and if there's one buy or many or how that worked. And but the fact of the matter is, really, when you break this down, I think, Kyle, the truth of the matter is, these kind of things are probably not coincidence. Somebody leaked something, probably, whether in the Saks case or another, you know, I'm not sure. But the reality is that there, you know, wherever there's potential for profits and gain, there's always going to be somebody that's going to be, let's say, you know, playing with the system. Somebody's going to be trying to figure out the best way that they can manipulate, the best way that they can profit. And some of it goes undetected. Some of it goes absolutely without any question. Nobody gets caught. It's under the radar. And then sometimes that it's so large and blatant that, of course, they're caught. But I would think that that's the, you know, those times that the investigators find out what's going on and do something are far and few between. But if you want to ride the coattails on the potential for things like this, what you may want to do is if you have the ability to bring up options because they're highly leveraged and short term. So therefore, anybody that's betting a lot of money on one way or another maybe has a little bit better information than we do. So you pull up options and you find those and sort them by, let's say, the most actively traded, and then find the history of how those options have been traded previously, and find out if there also, if you can, if there's any block trades in it, and if in fact there is some murmurs around about the potential for some kind of an acquisition or maybe some bad news coming out or whatever direction the options are signaling. And then what you can do is either you can buy options as well. You know, you don't know anything. You're just following along with what the options valuation and trading is doing, or you could buy the stock if you want to do so and play along that way. Now realize that when you use options, they are basically a time-sensitive vehicle. So here's what I always say about options. With a stock, it can go up or down, and you have all the time in the world to be right or wrong. With an option, you have to be right twice. You have to be right, number one, in direction, and you have to be right in your time frame. You actually also have to be right in the pricing point that you put in, because if you're right about direction and you're right about your time frame, you have to make sure the price is above where the strike price is on the option or below, you know, puts versus calls. You know, the other options that you could do is you can create spreads and various different options positioning where you're going to buy, let's say, a put or sell a put and buy a call or sell a call and kind of put them together so that you have limited, a little bit less, you know, potential for losing money or limited amount of money that you can lose because you're going to be selling and buying at the same time. But if you want to get the greatest bang for the buck and just follow along with where you see significant options volume played on a particular vehicle that you usually don't see in the past, and you got to look at different time frames, you got to look at the different strike prices, et cetera, and see where it is comparatively. But if you can do that and analyze that, you know, the potential is that you can catch one or a couple over the next, you know, let's say number of months, and all you need is a couple to really make it big. On the other hand, you realize that you're going to lose a lot too because it's just going to be a play that didn't pan out, whether it's in the time frame, or whether it's at the price, or something that just was being used as a hedge for someone else. So for example, you may have a situation where somebody is long the position in a big way and they're trying to protect themselves. So what they did is they bought a heap of puts, or they sold a bunch of calls, or some other style of bringing together options to hedge a particular position in a portfolio. Now, if that's the case, you didn't read it right. Maybe not because you didn't read it, because it's really what you thought was going to happen didn't play out. It was just a simple hedge position, and that's not what you're looking for. So you got to, I think, practice a bit, find out if there's some kind of a pattern that you recognize, and then what you can do is maybe profit from it. But realize something, that it is a bit of a gamble, these kind of things, and it really goes nothing more than just trying to capitalize on someone else's play versus really doing the research in terms of what may be happening with the stock. But in general, just to answer the question, the information is supposed to be disclosed at the same time to the public across the board. And, you know, maybe it is or maybe it isn't. But the bottom line is that's the game you're going to play there, Kyle. So thanks for writing in. And by the way, if you want to write me, it's askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can just write me at any time and ask me any question that you want, or if you want to find out some information, whatever it is, askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And while we're at it, if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's the at sign, the ampersand, Andrew Horowitz, one word. Just follow along, Andrew Horowitz, and I usually have that information on the front page of The Disciplined Investor. There's a little button there, just, you know, follow Andrew, and you can just click that and follow along. And we put out all sorts of information about markets and things that are going on, and you're the first to receive the announcement or the alert that a new information piece has been posted, because whenever we post on The Disciplined Investor, whether it's a podcast or a research piece or an idea, it goes automatically to Twitter at that exact moment. So you're going to get it right away. You don't have to worry about, you know, clicking back all the time and checking out what's going on. So try to do that if you can. The other thing I want to mention to you is that, you know, Trigger Point Research, where we have the equity alerts, we have the breaking up, breaking down, the bounces, the pro package, all that good stuff. We've had some great calls recently, and particularly on some of the downside breakdowns that have happened. But one of the things that we decided to do was to start putting up some things that we call setups. Some things that we're watching, things that may or may not play out, but some of the things that are on our radar. And what we've done also is put some videos up. So you can go to Trigger Point Research and you can look there, and on the right side, you'll see all the different categories like breaking up, breaking down, etc. Click on the setups tab, or the setups icon there. And what you'll find is that you'll see videos that come up, and you can find that we're talking about, you know, things that we're looking for. What is it that a chart's looking like? What is the algorithm looking for and searching out in particular when it comes to breaking up and breaking down? And these are just setups, things that were, again, that may not actually work, But when we do have those that do work, what we do is we alert our subscribers and they get the immediate update of, hey, this is breaking up or is breaking down, is bouncing from this point to this point. Here's the range of what you're going to be looking at, where we want to have a stop, where we want to have our target price, and some of the rationale behind it. And if you want to check that out, there's a 14-day free trial to that as well over at triggerpointresearch.com/free trial. triggerpointresearch.com/free trial. I think I'm going to wrap up today just with this discussion about, you know, is it a good thing or a bad thing that companies have their, you know, earnings and they keep a lot of money offshore? This is there was an article written by Robert Green, and he wrote it for briefing.com. He's a gentleman who's been on the show a couple of different times, very smart guy. And he talks about repatriation of foreign profits for U.S. companies. And he says a big story in the media is Apple's overseas profits and how the company is able to hoard cash abroad without paying tax on it in the U.S. And the truth is that all U.S. companies with overseas presence do this because the U.S. taxes, they tax corporate income at the highest rate in the world. So he's basically saying that Congress needs to create an incentive for U.S. companies to bring their profits home instead of the strong disincentive it has created today. Now, he goes on to discuss this whole way of doing things and why companies do it and, you know, the whole idea of this and, you know, why there's money in Ireland and other countries around the world that are much more friendly to corporate profits than others, and then questions whether or not this is a manipulation on the part of the companies. And, he goes on to say that the current tone of the public debate is that Apple is somehow being devious or immoral by storing their profits overseas. Simple truth is that you get an incentive around the world if you do so, and the current corporate tax rate of 35% in the U.S. is a strong incentive to keep foreign earned profits offshore. And when Congress complains that corporations are not paying their fair share, we think they basically have no one to blame but the code itself. And, you know, who wrote the code and who approves the code? Well, that goes back to Congress, right? So there was a tax holiday back in 2004 that allowed for corporations to bring profits into the United States at a one-time low rate of 5.25% only through 2005. And that worked. And there was a $300 billion of overseas profits that were repatriated. However, some now argue the 2005 tax holiday was a bad idea. But yeah, you have to wonder whether that is he mentions a specious argument or not, and because it fails to take consideration that those persons receiving dividends reinvest their money, either as purchases or investments, and he goes on a few things. So I think that, you know, the fact is that it would be very good for companies that have offshore profits and offshore funds to bring them home, if you will, and to then find a way to spend that money here and do it on an efficient basis, because that would create jobs and that would create the incentive for growth and for other things. But you know what? It's not just the fact that they're being taxed at a higher rate. There has to be other incentives here in the U.S. as well. Basically, what we've seen over the last few years is that the Fed has carried all the weight, or at least 95% of the weight, on their shoulders for trying to kickstart this economy, and we call that monetary policy. When we talk about fiscal policy, which is the policy that is brought by the government through various tax code changes, incentives, and all sorts of other programs that may help corporations, you know, spend money here, that still is a gigantic question mark as to what they're going to do, when they're going to do it, and if it's even possible with this divided government, if it can be done. That's what I think has to be done. I think that there's very little disagreement about this. Get the Fed out of the markets. Get the Fed out of the money printing business. Get all of the central banks around the world out and let the economy run in a way that is efficient based on the competitive nature of the economies, rather than trying to just have a currency war and a debasement in order to create a better competitive environment. That doesn't last long because other countries will just simply do it themselves. And that's what we're seeing around the world now. And that's what we saw around the world historically as well, and that didn't end very well, if you do recall. So my two cents on this, and you know, I think that you have to consider, you know, whether or not companies are just abiding by the law and doing what they can, just like we do with our taxes, right? or they're doing something different. And I think that the first statement is more the actuality of and reality of what's going on than otherwise. We have a couple of great guests coming up, very many. We're actually booked for many, many weeks ahead right now. We have Tadas is coming on. I can't pronounce his last name, and we just call him Tadas, and he's coming on. We also have coming up from Market Smith. You know him as Mr. O'Neill, the son of the famous Bill O'Neill from Investor's Business Daily. And a really great slate coming up of many, many more. Don't miss me on the Frank Curzio show is on this week. You can listen to that. We'll also have a replay on the DisciplinedInvestor.com website very shortly. And again, if you have any questions, just write to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining me. Again, I hope you had a great Memorial Day weekend. See you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.